Okay, I would like to encourage you to take a look at 2 Samuel. We've been walking through the Bible a little at a time. We're in 2 Samuel now. I want you to look for just a moment in chapter 13. We have been through chapter 13, 14, and we are beginning chapter 15 today. But I want to very quickly remind you where we were. What we have is significant dysfunction within David's family. He appears to be a hands-off kind of father, where his children need correction and instruction and the guidance of a parent. They seem not to get that from David. At least you can read that into the Bible record. His oldest son decides to lust after the sister of the third son. Remember, the first six sons had six different mothers. He ends up entrapping her and raping her. And after biding his time for a couple of years, her brother, the third son, murders him, runs away to stay with his grandfather in a country some distance away. His grandfather was king of that country. During the story that we have read, Absalom, the son that did the murder, has been allowed to return, but the evidence was that he was under house arrest. And at the last of chapter 14, verse 28, he had lived in Jerusalem for 2 years without being received by the king. This is after staying with his grandfather for 3 years. He manipulated Joab, the army commander, to allow him to put a petition before the king. And the last verses of chapter 14, the king summoned Absalom, who prostrated himself with his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. Now, you got to read a lot into this, and you got to pull clues from other places, but let me simply tell you, he has moved from house arrest to something wider but still confined. And so my question is, have you, maybe the younger ones, this isn't true, have you watched enough Dragnet episodes to know what that is? House arrest is one level. What's the next level up? Don't leave town. Right? Okay. That seems to be, and I'm putting things that aren't right here to help us with this, but the evidence is that he was allowed to be out and about in Jerusalem, but was not allowed to go outside the borders of Jerusalem without the king's permission. If you read all the way through 2 Samuel, you'll find, and actually into Kings with Solomon, you'll find several other examples of this kind of thing. You've already seen the example of, don't let me see his face. Right? So now you've got, so he's moved from house arrest to don't leave town. So he's able to be out and about within the city of Jerusalem. And you need to understand that so you look at the next verse. I want to concentrate for a little while at the first six verses of chapter 15. This is what we're starting today. Mine simply says, after this. He's now been, I believe, released from house arrest. He's now free to move about the city. After this, we don't know if it's a month or a week or 6 months or 2 years. We don't know how much time. It says he did something. What did he do? Mine says procured. Yours may say purchased, bought, got. I don't know what it says.
Provided himself
what?
Chariot
and horses. What were the king's sons riding? You remember the day that Absalom killed Amnon? They were all riding mules, right? So they're riding sports cars. He gets himself a limousine. And I think that's the way you should read it. Along with 50 men to run alongside. Now, pause for just a minute. This is not ancient, what you're reading. This is contemporary. Where do you see important people riding in limousines with men running alongside the limousine? Where do you see this? Those are presidential motorcades. Who are the people running alongside?
Secret service.
All right. What is he doing? He is presenting to the world, to the people of Jerusalem, he is presenting himself as a man of wealth and power, and a man who is so important he needs a protecting group. So far, okay? Verse 2. Mine said he would get up early. Maybe the king didn't. Stand beside the road leading to the city gate. Now, When it says Leamington City Gate, it actually means something that isn't quite, to our minds, correct. The city gate is not the entrance to the city, where the center of the city is here and the city gate is way out there someplace. The city gate is the place where judicial decisions are made. That you go and read, go back to Ruth and Boaz when he had his confrontation with the guy who had the right of first redemption over the land that Ruth's husband and family had had. Right? He went to the city gate. This is the place of judgment. This is the place of judicial. And that becomes important. He would get up early, stand by the road leading to the city gate, and whenever a man with some lawsuit had to come before the king's tribunal, Absalom would call out to him and ask, what did he ask? What town are you from? And if the man answered, your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel, then Absalom would say, now pause before we look at what Absalom's going to say. Let's back up for just a minute. Absalom would say, where are you from? And if the person said, what?
Israel.
I'm from one of the towns of Israel. Okay? What did the guy mean when he said, I'm from one of the towns of Israel? What's Israel? That's the 12 tribes, right? No. The division had already occurred. We've seen evidence of this going well back into 1 Samuel. These are the 10 tribes that later break off. Are you from the north? Or are you from the south? He's not looking, are you from the whole of the country? He's looking for, are you from up there? Because you could be from Judah or from the south. You could be from the north. Only if they were from the north did he say this. Why? People who were from Judah, that's David's power base. That's David's power base. It happens also to be Absalom's power base because Absalom's from David's family. His other part of his power base might be that country way away where his grandfather's king. But as far as the nation is concerned, his power base overlaps with David's. So publicly, I'm reading a little into this, but I'm not reading much. I think most of this is here. He's checking. You're not from around here, are you? And then he would say this. And what's he doing? He's building a power base up there. You can't leave town. So he's waiting for them to come to him. And whenever they come to him, they got to come to Jerusalem for justice. He catches them and he begins to build relations. Now what does he say? Absalom would say, look, your case is just and sound, but there's not a one of the king's deputies who's going to listen to you. And then he would say, and in my translation it starts with O. Does yours start with O?
Mm-hmm.
Yours starts with moreover. Yeah. Mine starts with O. Barbara, help me here. They've erased the quote off the board. I was hoping to leave it up here for this purpose. There was something this morning where somebody sitting back there, they quoted Billy as saying so-and-so, and his wife stands up and says, you're not going to believe anything Billy says. And the whole place broke out in laughter. It was very funny. It was very funny. Okay. Well, here's the point I made then. When you just write it down, you can't capture the tone. Right? When you see this written here, you're not capturing the tone. And I want to suggest the tone. And the tone is, oh, if I were judge, I could take care of things for you, but you don't have a chance in here. They're not going to even give you the time of day. Now, what is the effect of that? They start thinking, huh, maybe he should be the judge. Now, let me now put it before you. I believe you are seeing a master politician at work. How does he start? He displays his power and his influence and then invites you to think, if he were just in charge, you would have access to that power and influence.
Did he know Jonadab?
Oh, yeah.
Did he learn his lesson from Jonadab?
That's a good question.
Who appointed the judges in the land?
David did.
David appointed all the judges. That's in the law.
Yeah. Then anyone with a lawsuit or a plea could come to me, and I would make sure he got justice. Now, time out for a minute. If you got a lawsuit, if justice were done, what would happen? This isn't hard. If you bring a lawsuit or somebody brings a lawsuit to you, and you go to court, what has to happen for you to be happy? It has to be decided in your favor. Right? What does Absalom say, in essence? You don't stand a chance. They're not going to give you the... They're going to just grind you up and spit you out. But if only I were judge, I could make sure that the decisions were made correctly, meaning that you'd get your way. And what does that produce? A sense of mistrust of David and a sense of a wish that Absalom could be in charge. Whenever anyone came up to him to prostrate himself, to bow to him, he would stretch out his hand, draw the man to him, and kiss him. Now, I didn't do this in the first hour, and I should have. Lyndon Johnson is famous for his handshakes. Do you know about Lyndon Johnson's handshakes? Do you know about Lyndon Johnson's handshakes? Would you mind being a victim?
Sure enough.
Okay. This is the first of the handshakes. Right. This is the second handshake. This is the third. You see that? You see that? Okay. This was the Lyndon Johnson handshake, right? You bring the guy in close. What are you saying? The guy's bowing to you. And what does Absalom do? Lifts him up and focuses all of his attention on him and says, "You're not to bow to me. You and I, we're close. I'm your friend and you're my friend." Okay? Is it true?
No.
That is not the proper answer. Is it true? Occasionally. Let me help you with this. Is it true? Occasionally. Okay. It isn't true as often as he says it. It's true sometimes. In 1992, there was a presidential election. They had a debate at the University of Richmond. At the Robbins Center, seats 9,000, not counting the floor. There were a small number of people on the floor, and for the first time, they were having a town hall format where the people on the floor would ask their questions. They had an audience up in the seats. They could have had 9,000 people. They did not. They had a very small allotment of people. The University of Richmond had 200 seats. That's all they could give out. There were, I think, an additional 200 seats that the various people had, and then a few from the networks. I was one of the 200 seats that had in one of the 200 seats the university had. They had a lottery, and I won a ticket, and I went. This morning, sitting over here, was a woman who said I was on the floor. I was one of the ones that was on the floor. So, small number of people. I came home from that debate, and I said to Barbara, Bill Clinton's going to win the election. I did not say that because I thought he was the best candidate. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. That was beside the point. What I saw that night was Bill Clinton had managed to make each person he talked to believe that he was their closest friend and that all he cared about was for that person to have the things they felt they needed to have. He was the best I've ever seen. I wasn't close and I could still feel it. It was amazing. I am told that George W. had a nickname for nearly everybody in the United States. Have you heard this? Okay, the big flap over the guy with FEMA down in New Orleans. Heck of a job, Brownie. Heck of a job, Brownie. That was one of his nicknames. He had nicknames for everybody. He knew all these people, and the nicknames were helping him remember who they were. He wouldn't remember their names, but he'd remember their nicknames. And that George W., whatever you may have thought of him, he had this ability to really make close connections with people, even if it wasn't real. Occasionally it would be, but he had those. Lyndon Johnson is supposed to have had a Rolodex that was the size of a football field. He had so many names of the people he knew. This is what powerful and effective politicians do. And here is Absalom doing it thousands of years before. Can you see it? Verse 7. First few words tell you how long this went on. How long does this go on? When does the campaign begin for the 2016 election of president? It started the day after the election in 2012, right? It took 4 years to do. I don't know that that's an accident. We happen to have picked a four-year cycle for this thing, and it seems like it fits. Now, what happens if he does this a while? Look at verse 6. Absalom acted like this with who? with every Israelite he could find who had appealed to the king's tribunal. And in this way, Absalom, different translations have different verbs here. What does yours say?
Stole,
yours says. I think that's the better translation. Won, mine says. Stole from whom?
Hearts.
Stole what? The hearts. Stole from whom? From David. He won the hearts of the Israelites from whom? He stole the hearts of the Israelites from whom? From David. So here is that northern 10 tribe area. All of a sudden, Absalom has built a powerful base out there, and David seems to be unaware. He seems to be totally unaware. Chances are he's also building a power base where he is, but that overlaps with David, so he's got to be a little bit more careful with that. Old, but maybe not decrepit. Old and tired, but maybe not finished. How long did this go on? Verse 7? 4 years. And after 4 years, Absalom says something to the king. What does he say? I want to be released from Don't Leave Town. You got it? Where does he want to go? Wants to go to Hebron. What does he say? I want to fulfill a vow I made when I was away with my grandfather in Geshur. I told the Lord if I was ever allowed to come back that I wanted to worship him at Hebron. And Hebron is where? Up in the north somewhere.
Is it near Geshur?
Geshur is a separate country, so it's not, it's probably closer to Geshur, but not real close, I think. Okay. The king said to him, verse 9, go in peace. Did Absalom go in peace? He did not. You've read this, right? That was your assignment last week. You've read this, right? Absalom sent couriers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, verse 10, when you hear the trumpet sound, you are to say Absalom is king at Hebron. With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem. My translation says they had been invited and had gone in all innocence, unaware of what was going on. Does yours support that?
Yes.
Which 200 men did he take? Probably the men his age who might have been supporters of David. And what's he doing? He's getting them out of Jerusalem where they can't help David. David is older. He's taking out some of his younger base, some of probably the more important leadership that the younger people might have had. Leaving what? Leaving a vacuum.
Does it ever say what those 200 men do? Do they go back to Jerusalem or do they stay?
It just sounds like they've been taken out of the picture where they can't help support David when the time comes. Verse 12, Absalom sent for Ahithophel. Keep an eye on Ahithophel. He was David's counselor, and he had him with him while offering the sacrifices. The conspiracy grew in strength since Absalom's supporters grew in number. Now, it will tell you later in the story that Ahithophel was part of the conspiracy from the start. One of David's most trusted advisors. One of David's most trusted advisors. But he was part of the conspiracy from the very first. Okay? Verse 13. A messenger comes to David. What does the messenger say? The men of Israel have shifted their allegiance to Absalom. Meaning, again, I believe, the northern 10 tribes. So, next verse, David says to his retinue, put on your armor, boys. We're going to ride off and put this rebellion down. How dare they? Right? That's what he said, isn't it? Isn't it? Huh? What does he say? Run for your lives. We got to get up and get going right now or Absalom's going to overtake us. Where did Absalom get all that power? David had put down all the country, all the countries nearby. He had a powerful reign going on. His army had crushed everybody. And here's Absalom. Word from, comes back that Absalom has declared himself king at Hebron, and David immediately says, let's run for the hills.
Seems like he caved off the fast.
Doesn't it though? What does he not do? I've been guiding you this way almost since the first of the story. There's no mention of him consulting God. What does he say? Run for the hills, boys. I have a friend, I told the first hour of this, I have a friend who every once in a while calls up somebody he knows pretty well, and when the guy answers the phone, he says, "It's all been discovered. Flee for your life." I don't know that he's ever been met with an actual reaction from the person, but I do find it funny. David says, run. Verse 14, up, let us flee, or we will not escape from Absalom. Leave as quickly as you can, in case he mounts a sudden attack, overcomes us, and puts the city to the sword. Holy mackerel. The king's retinue replied, David, what are you talking about? We've got power, we've got soldiers, we've got experience, we've got armor, we've got weapons. No, 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 let us go fight, right? That's what the army says, right? Oh no, what does the army say?
Whatever you said.
We're already packed.
Yeah.
We'll beat you out the door. Again, this is terribly, terribly surprising. But it reveals to you, and I can't tell you all of what's involved in this, but it reveals to you as far as David was concerned, this wasn't just a credible threat. This was a threat of the sort he had never seen before, ever. And he's ready to run. The king... My verse 16 and 17 do not seem to echo most of the other translations. So I'll simply tell you what I'm seeing here. In my translation, verse 16 says, the king set out on foot with his whole household. Verse 17 starts, the king set out on foot with everyone following him. The other translations in the first hour didn't support that. But what were the king's sons riding a couple of chapters ago? No. Mules. Sports cars. What's Absalom riding? Chariot, limousine. What's David doing? If this translation that I have, which seems to be alone, is right, he's on foot. Okay? Well, you look at verse 30.
How would the king be on foot?
Interesting, isn't it? Would you please read verse 30? Does it say at the end of this, weeping as he went, his head covered and his feet bare?
As he walked up the road.
Right. The picture in my translation is he was walking the whole way and he was barefoot for part of it. I've seen that. I've been in Jerusalem. I've been on the Mount of Olives. It seems like it's going down into that valley, back up the mountain on the other side, and he's walking on all those stones and all those rocks, which was a sign of mourning, and it also is going to hurt his feet like crazy unless he's tough. Tougher than probably he was in those days. Verse 16, he left 10 concubines to look after the palace. Keep your eye on those. He set out with everyone following. They halted at the last house. That's the end of verse 17 for me. Where's the last house? Maybe that's the last living quarters within the palace walls. Maybe that's the last house of the people he's picking up to go with him as they're leaving Jerusalem. Doesn't say in a way that's clear to me.
Some distance away,
it sounds like.
This was at the edge of the city.
Verse 18. His officers, one translation said, stood at his side or marched in array past him. Take your choice. I think your translations probably say marched past him. Then it says the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Those were like the palace guard and the sort of secret service all combined in some way. These were the king's bodyguards and so forth. Along with, look at the rest of verse 18. I didn't find this in the first hour, so the first hour didn't get this. But what's the rest of verse 18? Who else goes past? Led by who?
Ittai
and all the 600 Gittites who had come in his retinue from Gath. Now, way back there, he had 400 men. A little bit later, he had 600 men. Remember all that? Those 600 were coming from Gath, that city where he first took refuge. Way, way, way back. The scoundrels and all the others probably.
That was in Philistine territory.
Yeah. And Gath was in Philistine territory. So these were people, foreign, you would call them mercenaries, except they seemed to be really, really loyal, and you don't think of loyalty as a characteristic of mercenaries.
That was my question. Where is Kereth and where is Peleth?
Well,
why didn't he just say Judean?
Those, I don't think those are necessarily places as much as titles. My impression is it's like the king's bodyguard and the palace guard. However you divide those things up, I think that's what that was. The king said to Ittai, the Gittite, I like Ittai, the Gittite. I'm going to say that two or three more times just because I like the way it sounds. That's verse 19. Ittai, the Gittite. Why are you coming with us? Go back and stay with the king. For you're a foreigner, indeed an exile from your homeland. You arrived only yesterday. Should I take you wandering with us today when I don't know myself where I'm going? Now pause, because there's about five important things in there. First of all, it's Ittai the Gittite. We get to say that one more time. All right. What else is in there? He says, you're a foreigner. You don't have to go with us. You don't face the same threat that we do. And then he says, you should stay with whom? Who's the king? David is the king, but he's not referring to himself. What is he doing? This is a step beyond what you've seen so far. He's recognizing Absalom has it. He has the throne. He has the power. And he's the king. It's hidden in there, but if you watch, you'll see it about two or three more times. There's a reference that David makes to the king, and he's not talking about himself.
Bill, might it be that Absalom somehow has stolen the resources of the kingdom? Because if David's on foot, that strikes me as being odd.
Well, see, that's why in my translation, when it has those words, I think they're significant. I don't like that the other translations don't support it. But it does say in verse 30 that he walked barefoot. I have this picture that Absalom has somehow built himself a power base under or inside of David's power base in the south, has added this power base in the north, and David suddenly realizes how precarious his position has become. Absalom has pulled all this out, and at this place you could almost see David abdicating to him, recognizing Absalom has the power. He is the de facto king.
I mean, there's probably other places in the scripture where it says they walked and they were mourning and throwing their dust. You know,
that's a piece of it as well. It could be that it's simply a symbol of mourning. Okay. Ittai's response in verse 21 almost has echoes of Ruth when she's speaking to Naomi. Did you spot that when you read through it? It's not quite as lofty as Ruth's, but it's close. As the Lord lives, and as my servant, as my Lord the King lives, wherever my Lord the King may be, for death or life, your servant will be there too. David then said to Ittai, go ahead, march past. And Ittai of Gath marched past with all his men and with all their children too. The entire population was weeping aloud as the king stood at the bed of the Kidron River. That's the valley that's between Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives. And everybody marched past him, making for the desert. I believe that's westerly, this way, and if Absalom returns, he's probably coming in from the north, so they're not crossing where Absalom is. Everybody okay?
The other thing neat about Ittai the Gittite, other than the name, is that, I mean, apparently, you know, Obed-Edom was a Gittite too, which is where he housed.
Oh, I'd forgotten
he
that.
He felt comfortable housing the ark, because when he was trying to bring
That's right, he was still in Gath at that time, wasn't he?
Right. So there, I mean, Gittite could have been the son, who knows?
Cameron?
18 to 21 to me sounds like a little bit like some sort of passive review.
And that's the picture. And so the question is, are the officers passing in review, or are they standing with David as the soldiers passing in review? The translations seem to be inconsistent. But the rest of it, it sounds like the king is like the captain going down with the ship. He's the last one to leave. It says the entire population was there. That's Jerusalem. Not everybody in Jerusalem was going. So the entire population was weeping, but these that were marching past the king were actually going with the king. And that's a somewhat smaller number. I think that's the picture that you want to have. Verse 24, Zadok was there too. Who's Zadok? If you've forgotten, he's one of the leading priests. And what does he have with him? He's got a bunch of Levites and they're carrying something. What are they carrying? Ark of the Covenant. Very significant. What does David say? Take it back. If God wants me to see it again, he's going to let me see it in Jerusalem. Very interesting statement. The ark represented the presence and power of God. David did not see that representation as representing God himself. And that's a much more advanced view of God than anybody around him would have had. they would have seen the ark as a talisman, as sort of a magic wand kind of thing. David did not see that. If God wants me to see it, you can almost hear him say, he will bring me back to let me see it. And there's a higher view of God that David seems to reveal here. Verse 27, he sets out a network of spies. You and Abiathar, you're the priests. You get back quickly into the city, take your sons with you, and then use your sons to transmit, to communicate with me out in the desert to let me know what's happening. When Absalom comes in, we need to know what he's doing. And he's setting up a spy system. Do you see that? Goes into verse 29. I'll wait in the passes of the desert plain until word comes back from you bearing me news. So Zadok and Abiathar took the Ark of God back into Jerusalem and stayed there.
I like what you say about how David has a higher view, because, you know, nowadays it's like, oh, once the Ark shows up, if it ever does, that's the symbol of God's divine grace.
And David himself says,
wins.
Yeah, and David says,
David didn't think that.
No.
Yeah.
Way back here, David did not seem to think that. He did not see it as a talisman, as God is here and nowhere else. God's power is here and nowhere else. Whoever has that controls the power of God. No, he did not see that at all. And I think this is the place where that maybe is as clear as any other. We've already seen verse 30. He's walking up barefoot the Mount of Olives. Verse 31, as he approaches the top, he was informed that Ahithophel was among the conspirators with Absalom. This is the point where it's clear that Ahithophel was in on the thing from the very first. David said, he finally speaks to God for the first time. What's his prayer? God turn his advice to folly. But David is not content with leaving it in God's hands. Look at the next verse. As he reached the summit where God is worshipped, there was apparently an early place of worship before the city of Jerusalem was captured. He saw, now what are we going to call this guy? We call him Hushai, as opposed to where shy and why shy and when shy and how shy. We're going to call him Hushai. And he identifies Hushai as David's friend. The Bible record identifies him as his friend. Coming to meet him with his tunic torn. Boy, I didn't do that well, did I? Barbara is remembering another thing she said one day. With his tunic torn and with earth on his head, he's giving signs, outward signs of mourning. David said, if you come along with me, you're going to be a burden to me. You have a picture that Hushai may have been advanced in age, not able to really travel very well. You're going to be a burden to me. But if you go back into the city and, I'm paraphrasing now, put your advice into the hands of Absalom, you can thwart the advice of Ahithophel. What did he say in verse 31? God, please turn Ahithophel's counsel to folly. And in the very next verse he says, and oh, by the way, just in case, God, you have trouble doing that, use Hushai. And I'm going to set Hushai up for that.
So finally David prays, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. Seeks counsel from God.
And you can tell how much he trusts Hushai, because if you follow all the way through, he tells him the entire communication string that he has set up to bring information out to him from the city. He tells him about Zadok and Abiathar. He tells him about the sons of those two. He tells him about the communication lines that they're going to be bringing word out to him. That is trust at a very, very high level that he's placing in the hands of Hushai. Are we okay? All right, chapter 16. Chapter 16. David had passed a little beyond the summit. He's come out of the city of Jerusalem, down over the river valley, back up to the top of the hill, just barely over the summit, when Meribaal's retainer Ziba met him with a pair of donkeys. Now let's parse through this thing. In my translation it says Meribaal, in your translation it may say Mephibosheth. Those were two different words for the same guy. Who is that guy?
Saul's
grandson, Saul's son, Jonathan's son. David had promised loyalty to Jonathan. Is there anybody of Jonathan's family left alive? Well, there is this guy, right? Now, do you remember who, I didn't do this in the first hour and I should have, do you remember who Mephibosheth or Meribaal was staying with when David got word of him?
Saul.
staying with a guy named Makir, M-A-K-I-R or M-A-C-H-I-R, of a certain place. Keep an eye on that. That's going to become important in just a moment. Anyway, Ziba comes in. Mine says with a pair of donkeys. I'm hoping yours says a string of donkeys because that's going to be better for what happens.
Pack animals.
Pack animals, yours says. And they're laden with loaves of bread, raisins, fruits, wine, all these kinds of things. David says the most interesting thing. What you going to do with all that? And what does Ziba say? I brought the donkeys for the king's family to ride on. If there's only two, that's a problem. If there's a whole string of them, that's maybe a little better. And I brought the bread and the fruit for the soldiers to eat, and I brought the wine for drinking by those who get exhausted in the desert. And then he asked Ziba about his master, Meribaal or Mephibosheth. And Ziba then slanders or tells the truth about Meribaal Mephibosheth. What does he say? My master sees this as his chance to get all his lands back. He's going to go into Jerusalem and welcome Absalom in. And David gives all the lands to Ziba. Is David doing the right thing? Maybe, maybe not. What does Ziba say in response? He basically says, thank you. May I be worthy of your favor, my lord king. So far okay? Okay. We won't see it today. We'll see it next time we're together. But keep an eye on that statement from Ziba. Verse 5. He's continuing. He reaches a place called Bahurim. And out comes a man from Saul's family. What's his name? Shimei or something like that. And what does Shimei start to do? He starts to hurl two things at David and all the people with David. What are the two things? Rocks or stones and curses. Okay. And it's pretty ugly. Tail end of verse 7, all of verse 8 quotes the curses. Abishai, one of his military leaders, one of the military leaders to David, says to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. Perfectly capable of doing so with just a moment's effort. And the king says what? Let him be. Maybe God sent him. And then verse 12 he says, and if God didn't send him, then maybe God will listen to his curses and take pity on me. Either way, I'm better off just leaving him alone. Verse 14, the king and all the people who were with him arrived exhausted at a certain place, and there they panted for breath. It doesn't name the place in my translation. I don't think it does in yours either. So far okay? Yes? No?
Yeah. Maybe he's been humbled a little bit. I mean, you know, before it was back in Abigail, you know, I'm going to come kill your husband, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a different situation. Mm-hmm. And he said, just let it be.
The picture now turns to Absalom from verse 15 of this chapter and on through verse 17 of the next chapter. Absalom enters Jerusalem with all the men of Israel, and with him was Ahithophel. When Hushai the Archite, David's friend, reached Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom looked at him with a little bit of a pinched eye and said, you're not much of a friend to the king if you're sitting here. And Hushai responds, the man whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, he's the man for me. Now let's look again. The man the Lord has chosen, the man this people has chosen, the man the men of Israel have chosen. Do you see those three groups? Who's the middle group? Who is this people? That's Judah and Jerusalem. That's Judah and Jerusalem. You've got the people coming in from the north. You've got the people who are already there. And he's attributing it to God. Is he telling the truth, Hushai? Absolutely not. We might struggle with that someday. Verse 20, Absalom said to Ahithophel, think carefully, what shall we do? Pause for just a moment and skip to verse 23. At that time, whatever advice Ahithophel gave was treated like what? Mine says like a decision obtained from God. As it was by David, so it was by Absalom. In this way was all of Ahithophel's advice regarded. So back in 20, Absalom says to Ahithophel, what shall we do? Think carefully. What shall we do? What did Ahithophel say? Got those 10 concubines. If you go take them publicly in front of all the people and have sex with them, that will prove that this is not a rebellion that can be cured. It will say this is permanent. And he does so. You can hear the words of Nathan. You can see Nathan's finger as he pointed to David and said, from your own family is going to come such turmoil that you're never going to believe it. This is coming true. Verse 22, a tent was pitched for Absalom on the flat roof and with all of Israel watching. It looks like the people of Judah might not have watched. Absalom went to his father's concubines. Verse 1 of chapter 17. Ahithophel went to Absalom and said, let me choose 12,000 men and set off this very night in pursuit of David. I'll fall on him while he is tired and dispirited. I will strike terror into him, and all the people who are with him will run away. I'll only kill the king. That's the only thing you need. You need the king to die. Middle of verse 3, I'll bring all the other people back to you like a bride returning to her husband. You seek the life of one individual only. The people as a whole will have peace. This seemed a good suggestion to Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Was it a good suggestion? If Absalom wanted his rebellion to succeed, it's the best advice he could possibly get. Verse 5. What did Absalom say? Let's get a second opinion. And who does he call? Hushai. And what does Hushai say? You know, for the first time I can ever remember, Ahithophel's not giving good advice. He describes David as an old bear. He may be tired, but he's still got claws. And the people with him are trained fighters. You go against him, you're going to lose. And when you lose, all of your people will be dispirited. No, wait, build your forces even bigger than the 12,000 you're talking about. Get it up 10 times that many. Go against him in force, because otherwise you're in trouble. Verse 14. What did Absalom say? What did the people of Israel say? Again, it's either everybody or it's the people of Judah are silent. What do they say? Hushai has given advice that's better than Ahithophel's. And then it continues after the quote, the Lord having resolved to thwart Ahithophel's shrewd advice and in that way bring disaster on Absalom. If you look at verse 15, the communication out to David begins. Hushai talks to the priests, and the priests talk to their sons, or send word to their sons. Notice how it says in verse 15, I really like this, and I don't know if it's echoed in your translation. Ahithophel gave such and such advice to Absalom and the elders of Israel, but I advise so and so. Isn't that great? I like that summary. Send word with all speed to David and say, do not camp in the desert passes tonight, but get through them as fast as you can, or the king and his whole army may be annihilated. It says in verse 17 that the two sons were waiting at a certain place. A servant girl was supposed to go and tell them what to say. And it turned out Absalom's people got there almost as fast as she did. Something about Absalom's people picked up something about this communication thing. They were hidden in a well. Do you see that? And finally, after all of them went back to Jerusalem, this is verse 20, verse 21, they climbed out of the well, went on to David, got David's group moving again, and they crossed, verse 22, they crossed the Jordan by dawn. No one was left. Everybody had crossed the Jordan. Crossing the Jordan was tough. Verse 23, when Ahithophel saw that his counsel had not been followed, what did he do? He committed suicide. He's not walking, though. He saddles a donkey and rides it back to his own place. Verse 24, where had David gotten to? I want to say Mannheim because I want to say Mannheim Steamroller and think about all that music and such, but that doesn't work, does it? What is it?
Mannheim.
Mannheim or something like that. Can we all agree on Mannheim for the morning? He reached Mannheim by the time Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Now, verse 25 and 26 gets complicated. There's a couple of different translations in here. Remember, we've dealt with different words at different places, right? Right? Okay. But I want to try to show you how complicated this might be. I don't know all of this for sure, but here's what we've got. Absalom put somebody in command of the army in place of Joab. Why did he have to replace Joab?
Could have been loyal to David.
Because Joab was with the king.
He wasn't there.
But what, does it imply? It implies most of the army was still there. That may have been part of Absalom's treachery. Rivers, you were asking about that a while ago. That it appears that Absalom had most of the army still there. So who does he put in charge? Amasa, let's call it. And then it tells you that he was the son of somebody who had married Abigail. And it identifies Abigail as somebody's daughter and somebody's sister. Right? If you're the daughter of somebody and you have a sister, what's the suggestion? I'm a daughter. I got a sister. I'm the daughter of this person. I've got a sister. What does that suggest? This person's David's family. Now, it may be father with different mothers, that's it, but there's not going to be probably different fathers. In my translation, that man is called Jesse. It's not called that in your translation. And I'm bothered by that. I don't know why it's called Jesse in my translation. If it is Jesse, then who is this? David's sisters. In any event, whether it's David's sisters or not, look at these. Mama of Amasa is this one, and the sister has a son. What's the son's name? Really? Mine says Joab. I'm still looking at verse 25, the tail end of verse 25. Right? You got sisters. One of them gave birth to Amasa, the other sister gave birth to Joab. Who's Joab? The army commander that just got replaced by Amasa. You're talking almost Civil War kind of stuff. Brothers from the same family fighting leader, two different sides. Everybody still okay? And it says that Israel and Absalom pitched their camp in the territory of Gilead. The last little bit of this section, verses 27, 28, 29, tells you about three people who come and bring provisions to David when he's at Mannheim. Three people who bring him provisions. Who's the first one? Shobi. Who's his daddy?
Nahash.
Now Nahash is the guy you have in place of where I had Jesse. You guys, I think, have Nahash. What does that say? Somebody who's come from the same family as the person who's just been appointed as Absalom's army commander is bringing David provisions. So take your choice which place the complexity comes. It's one place or another, it's there. Where is this guy from?
Rabbah.
Keep going.
Ammonite.
Rabbah of the Ammonites. What's the last time we saw Rabbah of the Ammonites? I told you remember that place. We flagged that. Where was that place? That was the place that Joab and the army were attacking while David was consorting with Bathsheba and then plotting the death of Uriah. What did he do with the people of that place? He made them slaves, if you remember. He treated them harshly. And here's somebody from that town bringing him help. Somebody who may be kin to the army commander of the other side. This is out of context. Okay? Who's the next guy?
Machir
from Lodabar. Who's that? That's the guy who had given a home to Meribaal Mephibosheth way back when. In one translation it's M-A-C-H-I-R, in another translation M-A-K-I-R. I don't know which way yours has it. Right? Meribaal, remember, was accused by Ziba of having gloried in David's fall from power. This is my chance to get everything back. You would think if Machir had been giving him a home that he might share those sentiments. Doesn't seem to be the case. Who's the third guy? Now, all of a sudden, at this point, I start thinking about the Godfather.
Yes.
Barzilli, I think, was the Barzini. Barzini, thank you. Barzini was one of those. And if you actually watch, and I do not suggest that there is much of a parallel between the way Francis Ford Coppola put that together, or the way that Mario Puzo put the novel. But there are moments in here where watching the one, you sort of have sense of the other. Okay, there's a sense in which blood is more important than anything else, and these blood ties, it's almost Sicilian in its ramification. And there's other parallels as well that we maybe see later. Anyway, here's this third guy. I want to call him Barzini. I really want to do that. But where's he from? He's from Gilead. Where had Absalom just pitched his tent? In Gilead. These people had brought things to support David. When you look at where they're from and what they're doing, you think to yourself, why are they doing this? And aren't they doing this at great risk to themselves? And the answer to that is yes. They are doing that at great risk to themselves. They brought all these things in and said, they presented it to David and the people with him. The army, they said, must have been hungry, tired, and thirsty in the desert. Okay? Now, we are at a stopping point, and the clock on the wall says we need to stop. So I want to give you one small assignment before you go on, because we're probably going to start with this. I want you to read Romans 5:8. I want you to read Romans 8:28. And I want you to read all of Psalm 3. There's more that I'm going to take you to, but those are the big three. Romans 5:8, Romans 8:28, and Psalm 3. And if you look at Psalm 3, you'll recognize David wrote this at this point when he's fleeing for his life from Absalom. Psalm 3, it's marked, that verse 0 I took you to a while back, there's a verse 0 that's there. Now, we've got a lot to go. We're in the middle of the story. It would be better if we could finish the story in one day, but we can't. So I'm going to have to trust you to keep reading ahead. Go ahead and read the rest of 2 Samuel. It wouldn't hurt you to read into 1 Kings. There's some things that happen under Solomon as you transition from David to Solomon. It's almost, again, that's where that weird parallel is between the Godfather movie. You see the Godfather talking to his son about some things, and you see David talking to Solomon. And there's some similarities, very interesting similarities that are there. I don't want to admit that, but it's still true. And so if you read through this, but also read Psalm 3. Read those two passages in Romans. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we've seen on the board today some people who are dealing with some real hard times. And we understand that hard times can come to people, and they can come to people almost in an instant. Life is fragile, and life is not very predictable sometimes. So we pray your blessings on those who need your blessings, your consolation on those that need that. Those for whom life has some uncertainty, and we specifically note our brother Bill Whitaker in that context, we pray that you would give him a sense of guidance and purpose that would carry him through this time of transition. And we also pray for our church that we would be able to make the adjustments necessary to be able to do the things that need to be done without him being part of what's leading us in that. We thank you for our chance to look at your word. We pray that you would make it come alive in our hearts and in our minds, that we can understand better both how people who have a heart like yours function, and more importantly, how they come back to you when they've fallen away. And today we pray for ourselves that you would guide us, guard us, bring us back together when it's time to do that, and that you would be with us, blessing our work in your name each week. We pray all this in your Son's name.